This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 245. I'm Chris Stafford. And on this week's episode, we'll hear from Mary King with advice on how to take care of your horse when he's out of work, whether you're roughing him off completely or keeping him ticking over during the winter months. And in our continuing series on past presidents in this 60th anniversary year, we'll be hearing from Brian Sabo, who was president from 2011 to 2013. And we begin with Mary King, who I managed to catch up with before she set off on a very special adventure, which we'll hear about at the end of the interview. Mary, hi, thank you for taking the time to do this.
That's okay.
Well, good to talk to you again, and I know you're a busy woman, so let's get down to business. And it is, of course, that time of year when horses start to be turned away, and the good old days, I know you and I would rough them off completely, but not, of course, everyone does that these days. So give us some ideas of what they can do if they're not just chucking them out in the field and bringing them back up after Christmas.
That's right, yes. As you say, times are changing. And also, I think with restrictions of turnout and land, you know, a lot of people don't have the luxury of being able to just turn their horses out 24/7 in a field during the winter because, as we all know, what a mess horses can make of fields. But I'm lucky with friendly farmers around where I live in Devon that I've continued that old-fashioned way of just literally turning them out, taking their shoes off, and they go out in bunches in different fields. And, you know, I think it's really, really good for them. They, you know, love going, stopping working and just going all rough and fat and hairy and wild. But then they absolutely love coming back into work in January. It's sort of, they come back with such enthusiasm. But as you say, many people give their horses a short break and then start working them. And, you know, depending, as I say, on what sort of place you have. I know a lot of the riders still turn their horses out a lot, but do start to ride them as well, maybe just whether they turn them out all sort of through the night and bring them in and then work them and then turn them out for the rest of the time. I'm not sure, but, you know, I think different riders do different things. But, yeah, I think that, you know, lots of people feel it's not right to just let the horses down completely and so that they get very unfit, because then it's such a lot of work to get them back up to being really fit again for the competition season. But again, you know, so I feel I'm very fortunate. We've got great big hills around us and the horses go out in hilly fields, and in fact they keep themselves pretty fit even on their holidays.
Yeah, I would imagine that to be the case, really. And, you know, when I think of maybe just here in the US, they may be on much flatter terrain. You think of Florida and where they might be turned away in Florida, which is absolutely flat, and other parts too.
Yeah, beautiful paddocks that are all, you know, beautifully fenced, smaller paddocks. Well, you can understand that's not very good for a horse to be in a smaller, flat area for a long period of time. So, so I can see people's, you know, reasons for why they feel they need to get working them quicker.
So let's think about some of the ways they can just keep them ticking over without actually doing too much schooling per se, not too much time in the sandbox, but some other ideas of just keeping them ticking over.
Yes, well, I think so you don't want to, you feel their downtime, you don't want to be putting pressure on them. They will have, you know, especially maybe an advanced horse, they've had a busy or whatever, you know, even sort of novice or intermediate horse, if they've been competing through the year, they would have had a lot of intense work for many months. And although you're wanting to keep them ticking over, I think important just to, you know, let them have fun, you know, keep working them, but not putting them under pressure. If, you know, if you have a chance to do much more, just hacking out on trails, as you call them in America, isn't it? We go hacking along bridleways in England. but any sort of, riding out on a, you know, longer rein, I mean, still getting them to behave themselves, you know, not allowing the spookier horses to take advantage and you know, try and whip around at something that's spooky, you know, be ready to, you know, to keep them straight and forward and off your leg, you know, so that they're marching on properly, but not to be riding them on the bit and to be drilling them sort of into an outline and all this business, you know, just let them be sort of quite relaxed. So I think, yeah, sort of nice, you know, plenty of hacking out, you know, maybe a little bit of work in the school on some days, but more rather than riding them in an outline, more sort of suppling work, just, you know, being aware of keeping them, as I said before, forward in front of your leg, but also, you know, then working on their length bends, so bending, you know, serpentines, getting them to sort of stretch through their body one direction, the other direction, and also over their top line without riding them too in a too short an outline, but riding them round forward over their back at walk, trot and canter. But just so it's sort of fun for them and not doing it for too long periods of time.
Now, one of the other things, of course, and this may be another old-fashioned thing that maybe you don't see so much now, is riding and leading. That would be one way just to pony them off another horse to keep them moving.
Yes, I do that around, again, it's what you, what situation you have at your place, but where I live, we've got, we go do a lot of road work, which I feel is good for the horses, but we've got quite quiet country lanes, so it is safe to ride and lead the horses. I mean, some, you know, some don't lead as well, or some aren't so good at riding them when you're leading a horse, so it's, I sort of, you know, make sure I do it in a safe way, but that's, you feel you can give them a nice bit of exercise without the weight on their back by leading the horse, rather than thinking, well, I want to work the horse today, but I don't really want to be on his back, so then I'll lunge him, which, you know, lunging is okay, but you don't want to be, they don't want to be going round and round in circles a huge amount of time. It's not good for their limbs and their minds, really.
And now, what about long reining? Is that an optional form of exercise without, you know, being too much, you know, too disciplined in terms of in an enclosed space? If you were able to go off around a field, would that be an alternative to during the winter?
I suppose so. If you're experienced at it and your horse is sensible enough, to be honest, I never long rein because I don't feel particularly safe doing it. I'm happier even when I break in. I do all my own breaking in of all the horses I breed, and I do it all myself, and I don't long rein them because I just feel I can do it without long reining them, so I wouldn't really be the right person to ask, but I'm sure some people could long rein if they're fit and good enough to keep up the pace behind the horse.
Right, keeps you fit. Well, let's talk about management, stable management, Mary. And if you're letting your horse off for a holiday during the off season, maybe they're going out during the daytime, coming in at night, depending on where you live.
Yeah.
What about nutrition? What about feed and the management of feed? You know, to let them down off the protein, the carbs. Give us some ideas of what we should do and what we should not do.
Yes, well, it's not to do anything too sort of drastically, depending on what quality of pasture of grass you have at your place as to. Supplement their feed. If you have got plenty of good grass, it's literally they just maybe need a balancer of some sort just to make sure they have the right minerals and vitamins. But if they're not being worked very much, you know, don't be tempted to overfeed them. You know, I'm a great one for feeding. I don't feed a lot of additives. I try and keep my feeding very basic. But the horses are turned out a lot on good grassland. So, and, you know, so I think that's important. You know, there's so many supplements on the market that are all meant to make them jump higher and gallop faster. But to be honest, a good, you know, balanced diet is the best you can do. And if the horse isn't working much, plenty of fiber. If he's in the stable, you know, plenty of hay or haylage, and out in the field, plenty of grass, and then just the balancer to keep everything on the level. But, you know, depending also on how much weight they cover, they carry, you know, if they're, you know, definitely if they're getting fatter, you know, to cut the food right back, just feed them balancer and fiber. But if they are lacking a bit of weight, need a bit of help, then, well, I mean, the best thing is to ask a nutritionist who you trust. For example, I feed Bailey's horse seed in England, and I have a nutritionist out about once a month just to look at the horses, and so I can discuss each horse and what they're doing, and she'll advise me. And, I mean, they're the professionals. They know what to do, but, yeah, so... that's what I do.
Yeah, so basically keep it really as simple as possible, because, you know, we hear a lot about ulcers in horses these days, and as you said, there's so many additives, supplements, and so much hype and marketing around those, that it becomes more and more complicated, when really we should be keeping it very simple with very basic, you know, the foundation of horsemanship and stable management.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And, you know, remember, the fibre is the most important. You know, that's what a horse, by nature, a horse lives out in the field, lives outside with its head down eating for, you know, most of the hours of the day. So they're used to, you know, their body is made to cope with lots and lots of fibre, and not the concentrate foods that we end up giving them when they're, especially when they're competing.
Now, what about the other aspects? Of course, there's the shoeing. Do you pull all the shoes off? Do you leave the front shoes on? Vaccinations, of course, you know, that's a time to get the vet in and get them ready for the season as well. So talk a little bit about those other pieces that we have to remember through the winter.
Yes, that's right. And depending on your horse's hooves, I would, again, sort of speak to my farrier. I would, you know, think a farrier is a very good farrier is really important for competition horses, that you do use, you know, your best farrier that you can find and trust, and would, you know, get their advice. But generally, my horses would have all their shoes off when they go out on holiday, as long as they're going out for a couple of months. If they're only going out for 1 month, say, to take all their shoes off, you know, because their feet obviously do break back when they have shoes off, and if they've got nail holes, you know, they'll have nail holes from where the shoes have come off, and they do in time break back to where those nail holes are. Well, the trouble is, if they're then going to be shod in a few weeks' time, it makes it, you know, hard work for the farrier then to reshoe them if quite a few bits of the hoof has broken off. So, you know, as long as they're going out for at least 6 weeks or longer, I would take their shoes off. If not, I would be tempted to, definitely leave their front shoes on, and possibly, you know, if you trust them and they're sensible, to leave hind shoes on as well if they're just going out for a shorter period of time. But there are some horses, you know, say if they are going out for a longer holiday, but they have quite crumbly, naturally sort of crumbly hooves that aren't so strong, then it is definitely worth keeping the shoes on, because they can easily get very sore if they, you know, if they're very flat heeled by nature with a crumbly type hoof. They could get sort of so sore that it's, you know, cruel to them, really. They'd be better to have their shoes on. But as I say, I would talk to my farrier, who I would trust, and we would hatch a plan together.
Very good. Now, well, what about vaccinations then during the winter and getting ready for the spring season?
Yes, that's right. Well, obviously, the rules are now every 6 months, the horses have to have their flu vaccine done, rather than how it used to be annually in England. I don't know if it's the same with you, but they have more recently brought in that all horses have to be vaccinated every 6 months. So it's a good time, you know, during the winter when they're quiet to get them done, but you have to sort of think ahead to the following year as to when they're likely to be competing, when they're likely to have a break in the summer. So I tend to get my horses flu vaccines done right at the end of December or even beginning of January, even maybe when they've just started work, but because they're only walking, it's fine. But then at least, you know, you've got a full 6 months. The next injection won't get in the way of a competition that they might be going to. So, you know, slightly think ahead as to what is best, but, you know, make sure you keep within that 6 month period for your boosters.
Well, the one thing that is fundamental, of course, and it's easy to do when you turn them out completely, you rough them off completely, but what if you don't rough them off completely? How much should you groom them, do you think, Mary? And of course, again, depending on the climate you're in, but we do have a habit over here, if the weather is warm enough, we put them under the hose a lot, almost or daily, I think some of them would. So what would be your rules for grooming a horse that's not in complete work, just maybe just ticking over, but living most of the time outside?
Yes, well, I don't know. I always think they love to get all wild and dirty, but then obviously if you're riding them, you don't want to be, you know, putting your tack on a dirty horse because you could be making them sore. But yes, I think, and yeah, depending on the weather, obviously if they are sweating up quite a lot, you're going to have to be washing them down. But, you know, if it's cooler time during the winter and they can work, you know, without sweating too much, and they are being turned out a lot, you know, I would, you know, try not to groom them too much. I would, you know, maybe, you know, definitely make sure their obviously tack areas are clean. But, you know, depending on how fussy you are or, you know, how much you like to keep the horse really tidy. But I find, like, for example, with my four-year-olds, they live out all the time when they're working. And I bring them in. I literally brush the mud off where their saddle and girth goes and around their head, and I put the tack on and off I go. And, you know, they might be quite muddy, the rest of them, but they're happy and natural. And, yeah, that's just what I do personally, but I'm sure they don't mind a good groom. But
any final thoughts, Mary, about this time of year and some practices that have worked for you? Any final takeaway messages?
Yes. Well, rug-wise, I mean, I suppose depending on where you are in the States as to how cold your winter gets. But I find in England, you know, we do get a lot of rain over here. And when the horses have finished competing, they're obviously, you know, slim, fit, clean, and they would get very cold if they had no rugs on and it rained heavily for a period of hours out in the field. It would make them very cold. So initially, say if they've done, say, Burley horse trials, and that's the last event of the season in September, mid-September, and then they're going to have a holiday, maybe initially I would turn them out with a rug on, a light rug on, depending on the weather, but then try and get the rug off as much as possible, because what I'd like to do is to allow them to grow thick winter coats. The more you rug them up, the more they don't grow their coats. And then when it gets really cold, you end up having just to pile more rugs on them to keep them warm enough. So I would try and get their rugs off to allow them to roll and get muddy, and try and then start to leave the rugs off as much as I can. And it just, they seem to cope perfectly right if it's cold but dry, but it's that wet, windy, wet weather where it goes on for, you know, all day or all night raining. That's when it can be horrible for them without any type of rug on them. So at the moment, my horses, they're out, and they, I'm just starting to think that they've grown lovely thick coats. They're really dirty, but I'm just getting to the stage that the temperature's dropping. There is some long or some heavy rain forecasted, so I think I'll sort of any minute now start to rug them up a bit, because you want them to obviously keep their weight on. If they're cold and shivering, they're going to lose weight more quickly. They might then have a chance of getting rain scald over their backs, which is horrible for them, and, you know, just bad management. So, yes, so I think rug-wise, but don't be tempted to over-rug. You know, remember, you know, horses are used to living outside, really. They're, I mean, they're built to live outside, so not too much rugging up.
All right. Well, great advice, Mary. Thank you very much indeed for that. And as I said at the top of the program, you are a busy woman, and by the time this goes to air, you will actually be leaving South Africa and heading to Australia the long way. So tell everybody what you're doing.
Yes, I've always had this desire to sail around the world with doing horses. All my life, I've never been able to sail as much as I've wanted. But now that I'm not eventing as much, although I am still at it a bit, it's given me a chance to progress with my sailing. And I've signed up for the Clipper Round the World race, which is divided into 8 legs. And the Southern Ocean leg is November to December, which is perfect for eventing in England because all events have, you know, finished by the end of October. So, yeah, it's perfect timing to do this Southern Ocean crossing. So I'm flying out to Cape Town in 2 days' time. I'm going to teach for 2 days cross-country training, doing a 2-day clinic. Then I'm going to join my boat, and there's 11 boats racing around the world in this Clipper fleet. And our race starts on November the 17th from Cape Town, and then it's about 23 days of the Southern Ocean, where you have quite big seas and the roaring 40s, which is, you know, strong winds. We might even see icebergs if we go quite south, if our skipper feels we're going to get more wind and quicker sailing, because at the end of the day it's a race. So yep, we're looking to try and win. And anyway, hopefully approximately 23 days later we will arrive at Australia to just near Perth, to Fremantle is the destination. So very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. And please do stay clipped on to the Clipper, won't you, Mary?
I certainly will, because our skipper on my boat has already gone overboard because he wasn't clipped on, which was rather poor show. And in fact, he's been, when they arrived at Uruguay, the end of leg one, he had to be swapped for another skipper. So that was a real shame for him, but he didn't obey the rules. And it's very, very easy to go overboard if you're not clipped on in rough high seas. So I definitely will be clipped on.
That's reassuring, Mary. And I must say, kudos to you and the very, very best of luck. I mean, as I know, it's a passion of yours, has been for a long time. So this is going to be a big box to check. And I hope you have a lot of fun. Sail very safely and fair winds, as they say. And I'm going to talk to you after that.
Good. Lovely. Okay.
Thank you for taking the time to do this, Mary. And the best of luck on your trip.
Thanks, Chris.
And now, in our continuing series of USCA past presidents, we hear from Brian Sabo, who was president from 2011 to 2013. Brian, thank you for joining me and welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
Well, let's look back in the rearview mirror to that period when you were president, 2011 to 2013. What's the first things that you remember of that period, Brian?
Oh, gosh, probably driving home from a clinic and having Malcolm Hook call me on the phone, which rarely happened. And I was just cruising down the road, kind of exhausted from, you know, probably teaching 15 or 16 lessons that day. And he said, pull over. And I did. And he said, your name has come up as a candidate for president. What do you think about that? And it was like, oh, I'm probably glad I pulled over.
And
I always consider myself sort of a workhorse, not a governance person, but it was an interesting experience.
And what appealed to you to do the job then, Brian, if this was sort of an administration that you had not got your feet very wet in before. It was something that would be a new challenge for you.
Well, I've volunteered my whole life. My mentor in the horse business was Hilda Gurney, who was an event rider, then turned to dressage, of course, and became a medalist for the U.S. at the Montreal Olympics. And we've been friends my whole life. I mean, she raised me from when I was 7 years old. So, and she had been a friend of my mother. So she got me volunteering from a very early age. As early as 15 and 16 years old, I was really getting involved. By 18, I was the DC of our pony club, and kept going from there to all sorts of different boards. So I had quite a bit of experience with governance, but never as a president or even a vice president. Just lots of board of governors work, American Vaulting Association, California Dressage Society. So I was pretty active my entire career in volunteering, because that's what Hilda taught us to give back. But the idea of actually being at the helm was a bit daunting. And luckily for me, my predecessor, Kevin Baumgartner, had and Joe Whitehouse both befriended me right from the very beginning. And you know, of course, to be president, you have to serve on the board. So I served on the board for a number of years, and then vice president. And then from there right on to president. So the growth process of getting involved from the very beginning, which the USEA Board of Governors has put in place, really educates everybody who wants to, you know, who fulfills that role, educates them very adequately to what their responsibilities are going to be by the time you step in. So Joe and Kevin were instrumental in that, and Malcolm. Malcolm really became a close friend throughout the process.
And what did you see as the major issues on your desk then at the beginning of your presidency, Brian?
Well, as you know, you've interviewed Kevin. You know, Kevin, the main thing that happened during his presidency was what we fondly call the safety crisis. And, we had at that point a number of horses and a number of people who had been severely injured or worse at competitions, and we were in dire need of leadership both at the legal level and at the stability level, and Kevin provided that. He is just an amazing leader, and watching him guide the association through that period of time was very inspiring to me. And when you sit down with people like that, and you then ask yourself, well, what can I offer? From my perspective, it was, and Kevin was the one who really inspired this in me, was to take the association in a direction after the safety crisis had been handled by Kevin and the Board of Governors at that point, was to take the association in a new direction, a positive direction, without the, you know, maybe as much legalistic perspective that had to be had during that period of time. So my goal was to make a more grassroots outreach to increase the participation of children, to increase the participation of adults and adult amateurs, and to really put a focus on that, take the focus off of, not that we weren't always focused on safety, but to put the focus on growth and growth at the grassroots level rather than only on the upper levels and potential safety issues.
Talk a little bit about the public relations around that then, Brian, because they were significant too, because we were going through a period where, you know, there was a lot of focus on the sport.
Yes. Well, again, that was what I got to watch Kevin and Joe Whitehouse just masterfully navigate. They were amazing in that period of time, and I was at that point just a vice president, just a board of governor. So that was certainly key in everything we did, and remains so. My first year as president was when the no-fall rule was initiated, and so we were still in the process of presenting changes to the changes to the association that would allow safety to continue to flourish, and course design challenges were met, and so all that was still continuing, both privately within the association and publicly with our outreach to the press, et cetera. But that wasn't my primary focus. I felt that by over-focusing on that, we were sort of missing the forest for the trees. And so for me, the thing was growth in the instructional end of it. So I was a big promoter of the instructor certification program, for example. I was with with that from the very beginning, and really wanted that to be the the front of the system going forward, to put education and to put growth as the primary vehicles for changing the perspective of everybody looking at the sport.
And what else was on your desk then at that time? I mean, that was quite a lot to address right there, but what else was on your desk?
Oh, boy. There would be a lot of things. I think the key issue with agendas is that all of us who have had the position, we carry forward the agenda of our predecessor, and then we push forward perhaps our own agenda that then is then passed on to those who succeed us. And so there's really no president that could say, I did this. It doesn't work that way. As you know, in governance, it takes about 3 years, maybe even longer, to have anything come from idea to actual functionality, with the exception of something like the no-fall rule, that happened very quickly as an emergency thing. And that got pushed through, in my opinion, a little bit more rapidly than it should have. I think that people weren't looking, especially at the USEF level, they really weren't looking at the statistics that were available to make the right decision. But a decision was made, but it happened very quickly. And so it takes about 3 years for anything to really come through. So I continued with what Kevin was working on in his administration, and helping that to go through, not only in the safety, but for example, making sure the American Vending Championships was moved to new and successful homes. And it's kind of funny because Joe and I worked diligently to many, many trips to Kentucky, working on getting it to Kentucky, and we weren't able to do that, and it ended up moving to Texas Rose Horse Park, which was a big change for for that particular event, to go to the center of the country, dead center, as a matter of fact. Texas Rose is exactly equidistant from both East and West Coast. So that we consider that to be a big win for the sport, getting that event to move. But it's kind of fun to see it now go back to Kentucky, where Joe and I had originally really, in our conversation between the CEO and the president, we really wanted it to go there, but weren't able to pull that off in that period of time. So I would also say that, a compliment to my vice president of finance, Mike Winter, who, God rest him, has left us. But Mike was a very close friend of mine in the administration of the association, and I could not have had a successful term without him. And he literally, physically, and intellectually changed the way that the association looks at its financial responsibilities. Put us, together with the admin and finance vice presidents and the board of governors. We put the association back into the black, and really pushed it forward as far as making sure we had enough money to run the association effectively. So, but then again, that would not have been me. That would have been Mike and his vision and me helping him with that. He was truly phenomenal in that respect. And then I think that another area would have been our continued emphasis on volunteer activities. And that led to eventually, during my successor's presidency, Diane Pitts, that led to a good friend and unfortunately also has passed on, Don Trotter, that led to a lot of different awards, the SEMA Senat Award, Don Trotter's Award, and growth both in financial help and also for the organizers, and also publicity help for the organizers in generating more volunteer efforts, which is critical to the association. We were losing tremendous number of volunteers on an annual basis, and some events were really finding themselves challenged to be running. So that must have been an ongoing thing, and nobody can really take particular credit for it, although Don Trotter and Seth Spark Warmbloods were really the final impetus to pushing that through and getting some real action going. And another one that would have been a pass through would have been, a good friend, Board of Governor Lou Leslie, who has been, and Lou's funny, I think she's been on the slate on our nominating committee a number of times as president, and she always manages to skittle away and not look for that. But she, behind the scenes, is one of those people that's always coming up with great ideas. And she is the one who actually, during my presidency, then later through Diane, it began to work on the idea of area realignment, which was something that was a mountain of a goal. And she managed to, you know, help us all get through that and produce an end result, which I think is, it's one of those things where everybody resisted it at first, and now nobody knows it even happened, which is normal. You know, when Area 10 was added, when I was area chairman of Area 6, when Area 10 was added, and taking that part of the territory taken away from Area 6, because Area 6 used to be, you know, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Hawaii, and of course now Area 10 is in existence, and now part of that has also been shifted around again into Area 9. So these kinds of shifts do happen, but there's always turmoil when it happens, and it takes a steady hand to bring everybody through that, and all the presidents work together on those kinds of activities to make sure that it's smooth and seamless. So I would say that that's some of the stuff we worked on, making sure Young Riders is, you know, working properly within the area structure. That's an ongoing challenge that every administration has to deal with. So.
And what would you imagine would have been your legacy then, Brian, of your presidency? Are there things that stick out in your mind and that you feel that that's what you achieved and that's what you would have passed on to the next president, as you said, Diane Pitts?
Yeah, I think my legacy, if you wanted to call it that, would be to be steadily and effectively working behind the scenes to grow the association, to make the association very amateur and child-friendly, to keep the focus on the sport in general, not just the upper levels, although we certainly respect and want to play a major role in growing the sport at the upper levels, but the way to grow it is to grow it from the grassroots. And that's unfortunately an area that will be an ongoing challenge because, as we discussed before we began recording, you know, that our culture is in many cases not very conducive to bringing new people into the sport, children in particular. And my wife and I here in California have extensive experience in that. And if only 10% of the people who are training horses would adopt a riding school program and start bringing children in from the very beginning, this sport would double and triple in size in just a matter of years. And yet people are still existing in a sort of a sociological vacuum, thinking that their businesses are going to operate the way businesses did back in the 1970s and 1980s when upper-level riders could make a career from just giving clinics, and that's no longer the case. And so we need to make sure that so my legacy, if I would have had my druthers, it would have been to, you know, really have promoted that more effectively. But that's not what's happening, unfortunately. We're not seeing that yet. So it would just be quiet behind the scenes, making relationships with people and promoting people to, you know, their best efforts of what they're doing, all the vice presidents who carry the heavy lifting of the association.
Any final thoughts and fun moments, maybe, Brian, when you reflect back on that period that will stay with you, that you enjoyed?
Oh, I enjoyed the entire thing. I think that developing relationships with people who have differing opinions from me and being able to help us, you know, guide the association with, you know, knowing that the best interests of the sport are being promoted, I think that to me is always a pleasure. Every time I'm around the people in the sport, they're great people. That's my feeling. I enjoyed every second of it. I would never have done it. I would never do it again. We've never had a two-termer in the association, as far as I know. A couple of people have come back foolishly. It's super time-consuming, and so, I think being tired would be something I remember distinctly. But, you know, I really did love it. And I loved it, you know, working with the other presidents, and Joe Whitehouse as a CEO, and of course, you know, seeing all the changes in the sport over time, it's been great.
Yes, there's time zone differences for evening meetings, too, I'm sure, were challenging. Plenty of those.
Oh, yes, the fun of doing, going between clinics in my car on the cell phone, trying to stay plugged. I tried to be on as many of the committee meetings as I could. So I was doing, usually four or five committee meetings, and some of them go 2 hours long a week. And luckily for me, things would be on the East Coast time, so it wasn't late for me, it was early for me, so just a matter of organizing my schedule to be able to stop teaching for a few minutes and get on the phone, driving the car to another location. So I loved hearing people's perspective and promoting what they were doing and helping them to, do the best they could as vice presidents and board members to achieve their goals.
Wonderful. Well, Brian, thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing your memories of that period. We really appreciate
Absolutely.
It. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
And our thanks again to this week's guests, Mary King and Brian Sabo. If you've missed previous episodes of the Past Presidents series, then you can find them all on the website at useventing.com. And of course, if you listen on your smartphone, then you can find them at the USEA's official podcast channel. And on the next episode, we'll be hearing from Diane Pitts, who was president from 2014 to 2016. Until the next time, please do follow us on social media at US Eventing for all the latest news. And of course, check out the website for updates regularly at useventing.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy your eventing.